This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Thank you so much for coming out on this rather warm day, and I understand that the temperature we are in here now is as we will be for the rest of the afternoon, which I think's quite adequate and perfect. So, welcome. I'm Christy Anthony. I'm the chair of this session and the creative director of the Adelaide College of the Arts, TAFE SA, which is that hands-on training facility in Light Square. We have one of the most amazing advisory boards headed up by Robin Archer over here, and the privilege is mine, let me tell you. Welcome to the Adelaide Festival Ideas session today, titled Arts Costs, Entertainment Pays. Intriguing. This session is proudly presented by Flinders University, and we thank them for their ongoing support. And I acknowledge today that we're gathered on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains, and we recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs and relationship with this land. We acknowledge that they are of continuing importance to the Kaurna people living today, and we respect their elders, past and present. A little bit of housekeeping. I'm sure many of you have been in many sessions over these last fabulous few days. And I'd like to congratulate the organisers on yet again another extraordinary Festival Ideas. There's been an awful lot of thinking going on. Please switch off your mobile phones. Well, indeed, switch them to silent, because we are encouraging people to tweet. If you wish to do so, the tweet handle is at ADLFOI, and the hashtag is the same, hashtag ADLFOI. It's also on Instagram with those same hashtag and at symbols. Unauthorised recording of this session is not permitted at all, so please don't record it, because today's session is being recorded by Radio Adelaide and will be broadcast in the future. There will be time in this session for questions from the audience, and we'd like you to please participate as much as you wish to. There's a microphone in the centre of the room, and if you have a question, we'll ask you to come and line up so that we can keep it rolling. We only have an hour. You'll notice that we are without Mr. Andrew Bevel, and I'm sorry to tell you that the festival have asked me to pass on his sincere apologies to you, because he just simply can't be here today logistically. So therefore, we have more time for these two great minds, which I'm sure you'll agree is a pleasure. So it's my pleasure to introduce them both to you. First of all is Professor Julian Merrick. Professor Julian is passionate about his contribution to Australian theatre. He's contributed for more than 20 years. He's been a practitioner, a historian, a theorist and a critic, as well as an administrator. And he's been the Associate Director and Literary Advisor at the Melbourne Theatre Company, directing many award-winning productions in Melbourne and around Australia. He has been a research fellow at La Trobe University and is now the inaugural Strategic Professor of Creative Arts for the Faculty of Humanities at Flinders University. Fabulous position. Fabulous to have him in South Australia, contributing as he does to so much. Robin Archer, AO, is a singer, writer, director, artistic director and public advocate for the arts. In all these roles, her reach is global. She's currently Deputy Chair of the Australia Council, Creative Director of the Centenary of Canberra, which must be coming to a close end now, and the Artistic Director of the Light in Winter, which she created for Fred Square, Melbourne. Robin has performed worldwide and been an Artistic Director of the National Festival for Australian Theatre in Canberra, this Adelaide Festival of Arts, of course, as we'll fondly remember, the Melbourne International Festival of Arts, 10 days on the island, which she created for Tasmania, and two years at the European Capital of Culture. Robin continues to rack up awards on an annual basis, and we'd like to congratulate you for your recent Helpman Award for Cabaret, and adding this to the many orders and awards that you have. Robin is holds an honorary doctorate from Flinders University, so there's certainly Flinders binds us all here today, as indeed even the Adelaide College of the Arts is now proud to actually run a couple of bachelor programs with Flinders. So I would like you to join me in making them welcome. And now ask Julian, please, to take the stage.
Thank you very much, Chrissy, and thanks for turning out on this warmish day to have a listen. I've been away directing in Sydney, so I haven't been participating in the events associated with the Festival of Ideas. And this is my first time with the festival, so I wasn't entirely sure how to pitch, where to kind of land my ideas. So I thought the best thing to do was to just simply talk about what's on my mind. And like Robin, although in a much less illustrious way, I am both a practicing artist and somebody who's very involved in the cultural policy process. And I guess those two experiences have defined both my professional life and some of the thoughts that I'm going to share with you today. So, one of the many illustrious people who said that art doesn't pay is my mother. When I was 16 years old, I told her I wanted to go into the theatre, and she wept. She was a hard-bitten documentary producer, and tears didn't come easily to her. It's hard to define art, but one way is to study the reaction of others when we think we are in the presence of it or believe we have created it ourselves. If I told Mum I wanted to go into TV or Broadway musicals, I doubt she would have responded in the same way. Money is part of that. Going into the theatre can be profitable, but usually isn't. Musicals and TV pull a bigger crowd, so there's a living to be had out of them, or that's the received wisdom. The division between art and entertainment has been around for 150 years. It was Matthew Arnold's book Anarchy and Culture, published in 1867, that took the fateful step of framing popular entertainment in a positive way. Until then, it had been a 100% social bad, an incitement to political disorder without intellectual or artistic merit. Arnold wasn't for entertainment over art, but he talked about culture in a broader way, as a whole way of life, and not just something Oxbridge graduates could appreciate. It is ironic that one of his legacies has been to saddle us with the entrenched conceptual opposition between entertainment and art. Throw a rock in a library and you'll hit a book that takes up one position or the other. Recently, a third view has emerged, which is more nuanced. In his book, Dancing with Empty Pockets, Australia's Bohemia, Tony Moore makes the practical observation that all supposedly impermeable art form and industry boundaries are crossed by creative people all the time, with things that are called art one day becoming entertainment the next, and vice versa. Today, in an age of user-created content, instant electronic replication, and constant market innovation, this seems nothing less than the bald truth. Does that mean that distinction between art and entertainment has ceased to hold? I don't think so. The categories still say something about the different ways in which we respond to culture, different structures of feeling, as Raymond Williams would say. My mother's tears, like her support for me later through some tough years in the theatre business, were the result of a perception that some cultural activities are high risk but potentially high value, and that while professionally committing to them was not something a parent should welcome in a son, it was a cogent choice on a human level. Art has about it a quality of intractable presence that carries its own justification. By contrast, entertainment is defined by its acknowledged purpose, and while it may do many things, it is the entertaining function it must address first if it is to qualify for the category. I'm tempted to say, bad art is still art, but bad entertainment is just bad. I don't want to take up a position in the art versus entertainment polemic. The ground has been well fought over, and it's hard to imagine a further useful contribution to it. What I do want to suggest, however, is that these two different ways of looking and talking about culture have grown separate antipathetic value discourses. This estrangement is neither useful nor, in a world marked by technological and aesthetic convergence, viable. Bringing them together is hard, but it is absolutely what is required. Let me explain a little what I mean. All cultural activities have what we might call a general and a singular side to them. They have aspects that make them relatively easy to engage with, to interpret and to enjoy, and they have unique aspects, individual properties they insist on as part of their understanding and appreciation. All cultural activities have both characteristics, but the balance is particular in every case, and it is along this spectrum of difference that the art versus entertainment opposition digs in. Clearly, both aspects are important. If cultural activities contained only singular properties, they would be so maverick as to fall outside the zone of our common understanding. If they contained only general ones, they would barely exist as a set of specific forms. The reason art costs mentally, spiritually, and financially, is that it contains a higher proportion of singular properties and makes more demands upon us as a result. Entertainment is the name we give to those activities that make fewer such demands and so are more readily accessible. Think about going to a school fete or the footy. Compare this to going to a gallery exhibition by William Turner. If we were asked what we were doing, we might say going to a fete or a footy match, but probably not going to see some paintings. The named quality of Turner's work is what marks out viewing it as a more individual and demanding experience. We call our relationship with this kind of activity art, and it has some important psychological consequences. None of this would matter beyond the level of the descriptive, however, if it had not led to two warring discourses of value. Art has been the preserve of what is sometimes called the critical humanities, where the focus is on the singular qualities of cultural experiences, their formal complexities and meanings. Entertainment has been the domain of cultural studies and its cousin disciplines, cultural policy studies and the creative industries, where the emphasis is on industrial processes, social mobilization, and economic relations. Both discourses are capable of rhetorical excess. For humanities critics, there can be an obdurate insistence that only a restricted number of things have the right to be considered culturally valuable. This was the position, for example, of Marxist theorists like Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer. For cultural studies scholars, the boot is on the other foot, and the work of Tony Bennett or John Hartley shows a resolute refusal to admit aesthetic judgment into the value realm. The category of art and its attendant distinction-making is dismissed as a class-based device for the accrual of cultural capital. I massively foreshorten a debate that has now gone on for too long without getting anywhere interesting. It is the moment for art and entertainment to bring their value discourses into alignment, I think. This is partly a methodological problem, and this is where my experience of the cultural policy process comes in. Entertainment and art have different ways of publicly accounting for what they do. The general dimension of cultural activity lends itself to aggregate measurement, and broad social and economic indicators are a preferred and useful measure of culture as entertainment. The singular dimension requires singular responses, and the critical review remains the standard measure of assessment for culture as art. These different instruments of account bring with them different skews, but this gets lost in the polemics. There is no way to jump from a league table or a set of benchmarks to qualitative impact. No amount of knowing how well a book has sold will tell you whether it's worth reading. Likewise, the only way to assess the aggregate effect of something is to count it. A 5-star write-up of a Jim Buckley CD is no guide to its broader social use. It's hard to overstate how much confusion this antipathy has created, particularly at a policy level. Like cats in a sack, these two value discourses have sat in public consciousness without usefully cooperating. On the one hand, and most obviously, it breeds a market fundamentalism that will tolerate no critical distinction making. I once suggested to a Treasury official that Australian TV programs should be subject to quality review. If they were found to be crap, they should be taken off the air no matter how many people watched them. On the other, it leads to willful naivety about economic structures, particularly among artists. As a theatre director who works mainly with Australian playwrights, I must deal with the impact not having access to a commercial sector and the rewards that come with it has on attracting writing talent to the art form. It's as if our brains have been permanently cleaved in two, leaving us unable to take a rounded view of our cultural experience, as if the idea of something that both costs and pays were unimaginable or an algorithm unworthy of computation. The division goes beyond methodology and strikes at the heart of what it means to be a participant in Australian culture at any level. Why can't Australia make a program like The Killing, my mother asked me recently, who is retired now but maintains her professional interests? As a country, we earn four times Denmark's GDP and have five times its population. The Killing is a low-cost political crime drama whose merit lies in its narrative and character complexity and not in expensive locations or cinematographic effects. It is not a one-off either, but part of a cluster of successful and awarded dramas that have come out of Scandinavia in the last 6 years. Australia could make a series of similar quality, but does not do so. The reason does not lie in industrial structure and aggregate measures, but in the lack of a climate of critical discrimination within Australian TV as a creative unit, the failure to internalise norms of quality and risk appertaining to the relationship we have with art. In Australia, TV is entertainment, however constricting that view may be of its imaginative and social possibilities. Closer to my own field, I prefer not to read another media interview with another great hope of Australian playwriting, or vicarious celebration of one winning an overseas award, or meretricious comparison between classic and Australian drama. What Australian theatre needs right now is not more critical introspection, but better economic modelling, such that more and better career paths are achievable within it. Yet talk to most people in theatre and use the word industry and you will get a pained or uncomprehending look. It is only when artists reach middle age and the true costs of their choice of profession make themselves felt that financial return is seen as integral. Theatre is an art, even if that label deprives you of your right to make a living from it. We can talk more about where to go from here, but the art versus entertainment divide clearly needs kicking into a more fruitful orbit. The value debate lying behind it is stuck in the intellectual equivalent of Groundhog Day, and that is now costing all of us more than it pays. Thank you.
I won't even begin to sum up, I think. We'll just keep moving. Let's keep going. Robin, may I ask you to join?
Yes, sure.
And we'll have a good, proper discussion in due course.
I think I'll just sit here because I haven't written anything formal. So I'll just spin a few things. That was terrific, Julian. Very, very stimulating. I suppose there are very useful conversations that, I mean, very intelligent ones that have been about entertainment versus art, as you've summed up, Julian. And I think that there are some useful hours to be spent in comparing them. But I find flaws in the question because fairly clearly there are probably as many broke and out-of-work entertainers as there are broke and out-of-work artists. Similarly, one could say that I guess in the entertainment field, there are more multi-millionaires than have come from the arts. Nevertheless, there are many people who we would consider artists who do make in the sort of multi-millions as there are entertainers. So for me, the question's always been, or for some time has been, not so much about whether art costs, which it does, and entertainment pays, than the intent behind the people who are producing these things. So for me, if somebody's main aim is to entertain you, a lot of their thought will go into, what does the audience want? What does it like? What does it already know? What does it love? And how can I give it to them in a way that will give me more work and possibly more celebrity and therefore more money? Now, if that were the basis of judging entertainment v art, probably 95% of opera and ballet is entertainment. Because essentially there's only a fraction, certainly in Australia, there's normally only, although I think companies do their very best, there is only a fraction of their repertoire which will be devoted to new Australian experimental opera and ballet. It happens fairly rarely. And therefore the whole, and Julian, you'd be wiser on this, but the whole economy of those large exercises tends to be predicated on getting a good bottom line through your box office, for having good books, not making a loss, etc. And therefore the argument will always be, well, in that case, we have to put on things that the audience will come to. There's sort of no question. I had a very interesting conversation with both David Atkins at one point and Richard Tognetti saying, we would do more Australian works. It's just that the fact is, when we do an Australian program, very few people come to it. They'll turn out for Beethoven and Mozart and all those things. So there's a kind of chicken and egg in there. So for me, entertainment, if we think about a producer getting ready to do a musical, for instance, you know, a revival of South Pacific, for instance, and that can be an opera company as much as it can be a commercial producer at the moment, they will say, what hasn't been seen for a while? Who are some great singers and designers? How can we please our public? To me, this is entertainment. It involves a lot of artistry. There's no question that somebody who's conducting Rodgers and Hammerstein or Stephen Sondheim needs to be very musical, really know their work. It's a lot of very skilled musicians and singers, etc. But the ultimate aim is kind of to give pleasure with known repertoire and to entertain the audience. Art, to me, sits in a slightly different box. I could be wrong, and I'm happy to have the conversation with both of you about this, but art, for me, is always that thing which is an individual is more or less compelled to do. It has no, in its purest form, I would say, and we could argue about that as well, but it tends to be something that people have to do, just like you saying, I'm going to go into the theatre because there is a passion, you've seen it, you want to get into it, there's something driving you. And at the extreme end of contemporary art, it's people making things that are what I call the ugly, the unknown and the unloved work, which I believe still should be supported either philanthropically or by the state. But they're actually making this work because they're driven to do so. There is no profit motive in it. It is not even just about self-expression, it's actually saying, I've got to deal with these materials, their words or their visual materials or it's music, and I just have to do what's coming out of my creative process. And there isn't, now, there's nothing to say that that might not eventually end up paying. You might eventually, but it's not the motive, it's not the intention of the work, and that's kind of more where I do the division. I found it very interesting. I did an interview at the Sydney Festival a few years ago with the great theatre maker Robert Lepage. And Robert, as you know, he's brought some terrific shows to Adelaide and to Australia and has been considered for a long time a great theatre maker. He was at that time, and he was amused at my delight in his involvement in Las Vegas, because he went to do one of the Cirque du Soleil shows and they sort of were neighbours in Quebec, and part of the whole revitalisation of downtown, the wharf area in downtown Quebec. And during this conversation, Robert just said, good art always sells. And he had no embarrassment about this whatsoever. His belief was that if something was making a lot of money and it was considered artistic, it was probably just really good art. At the time, his budget for the new Cirque du Soleil show in Las Vegas, and now when Cirque du Soleil do a new show in Las Vegas, they pretty much always build a new casino for it. But his budget for the show alone was $150 million. But I have no doubt that, and I mean, he was very forgiving about Las Vegas. He said, you can't just call, I mean, it's a bit like this discussion, you can't now just call Las Vegas a sort of entertainment, gambling, fantasy joint, which it is, and marvellous for that reason. But there are a whole lot of really interesting businessmen who are interested in, there are young entrepreneurs interested in the development of technology and how that can be used in entertainment. But then I guess, you know, an artist like him learns it through that very commercial avenue and then can take it into his own art. So it was a bit of a give and take, and I have no doubt that that $150 million investment and Lord knows what the casino actually cost will eventually make its return. So it's an entirely commercial operation. It's got entertainment in mind and yet there's kind of art involved. Another example, just last night in Canberra, we've got these weekends going on at the moment as part of the centenary program called Spin, and it's absolutely everything on wheels. You can't imagine how many wheels are roaring around that city at the moment. And last night there was something at a great big old hangar and a workshop, and it was meant to be, its intent was entertainment. It was really meant to be not a highbrow cultural program, but there was a, and it was definitely not highbrow, but there was a car crushing demonstration, which was very exciting, and a lot of artists I know got very excited about seeing cars being crushed. It was fabulous. But there was a fashion parade. Donna Jackson is a community artist of some repute, and she got a fashion parade happening, and all the fashions were designed by local designers, and the dresses were made out of car parts. Everything came from car parts, from the seats. There was a bustle with the steering wheel, and there was rubber and leather and lights flashing, and it was so fantastically invented. And it was followed by a performance by a mob called John Brown. Have you heard of them? Two amazing people who get on a trapeze, and you're saying, are they a girl? Are they a boy? What? Oh, their muscles, look at all that. And then they take their tops off, and it's revealed that they're women. Nobody was quite expecting that they would take their tops off, not even the organisers. It's a very highly entertaining act they're doing. And that was followed by a performance by the rock and roll singer Mark Seymour, who had put a band together called the Petrosexuals, and they only sang songs about cars. And a wonderful female singer from Tamworth joined them. And it was truly one of the best sets of rock and roll I've ever heard. Now, interestingly, the intent was entertainment, but I found a lot of art in it. You know, I found a lot of art, certainly a lot of art in the costume design, and the way in which there were notes that Mark Seymour hit that seemed to me absolute, I mean, notes that any artist would have been proud of, even with this sort of rough throat. So, as you suggested, Julian, there is so much crossover between the two, but the way Mark had put together this wonderful set of songs, beautiful slides behind it, coming back to his own, one of his own cars, quite poignant in a way. And so there was something about that that was actually not just an intent to come in, have a gig, make money, and I think they'll do that concert again, but there was something, I don't know, there's something about art that intends to move you and does move you and makes it a bit different from sometimes the brash experience. And the minute I say that, who has not been moved by a great pop singer from time to time? Look, I could go on forever, but there are just random thoughts, so why don't we start the conversation?
Yes, if we may. So, Robin, when you're going in to produce, program or direct something, does the intent strike you initially that it needs to be entertaining straight up, or that it is entertainment, or are you always pursuing art?
Well, I think if you don't entertain the audience one way or another, there's probably not much life in it, you know. But I don't. I'll just give an anecdote of when I was growing up in Adelaide, because it also involves Flinders. Being the daughter of an entertainer, I was only an entertainer until I was about 26. And I had no motive in my life except to be famous and get lots of money. That's what I wanted to do. And there are interviews in the Advertiser where I say that kind of thing. And I basically sang whatever would make me famous in some way, folk music to rock and roll to, I had a band once called Robin Smith and the Heavy Piece, which was, we were singing Led Zeppelin, for God's sake, you know. I was really desperate, you know, just doing whatever I wanted until I met Wal Cherry, the founder, the late Wal Cherry, the founder and first professor of drama at Flinders University, who brought out John Willett, my late mentor, John being the principal translator of Brecht into English. And he came out as the dramaturge for the Throppney Opera. And we did the Seven Deadly Sins. We opened the space in the Festival Theatre. It was the first production in there. And then they started to feed me this other material from that Weimar repertoire. Mm-hmm. And I did a concert at the Art Gallery of South Australia. And I can recall a really heated argument between me and John and Wall when I was saying, but, you know, these songs are really hard for people and they're not entertaining the audience. And I know how to sell a song. I know songs with big finishes and happy lyrics, and that's what we should be giving audiences. And it took quite a long time. I mean, I then remained working with Wall and certainly with John for another 20 years. But it was amazing that instinctively, as a singer, I wanted to please the audience and I wanted to pick songs that would please the audience. And suddenly the experience of Brecht and those theatre, a dramaturg and a director, convinced me that my life would actually be better if I didn't just keep selling popular songs, but I did something that would activate the brain, that was worth something more. I mean, it couldn't be a more obvious moment in my life at sort of 26 or 27 when somebody persuaded me away from entertainment and into the arts. Now, if I try and put the money factor into that, it's very interesting because, okay, maybe if I'd pursued popular singing, I might have been incredibly rich and famous and a celebrity.
Are you suggesting you're not famous now, Robert?
No. I mean, but at a different level. Okay. You know, a young person with a good, strong voice, you know, I would have spent more on facelifts and teeth. There would have been a lot more money that kind of went into keeping me place where I could have...
Mega.
You know, yeah. I could have... But maybe I could have. You know, there's another side to all that, which is... you know, I know that I've got the same vocal range as Marilyn Horne. Mm. If I'd had different training as a kid, I could have been that kind of wonderful singer, I think, but I didn't. So what's interesting is that choice, which I don't regret for a second, has given me the most amazingly rich, I think, not only intellectual but moral life. Mm. I actually think that I've been doing things that... The thoughts of which, the core of which, are important. And so every now and then I dare to call myself an artist, but I'm a little bit careful about that.
Oh, really?
A little, yeah.
You
a little
snuck
bit.
Into the... You know, when I'm representing just, the arts internationally and globally.
When I'm just singing Edith Piaf, I'm probably an entertainer.
Yeah.
You know, but I always tuck a bit of politics in there, so
yeah,
it's okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As for intent, Christy, it's... The intent for a long time has really been to stimulate the audience rather than entertain them. Well, you hope that you entertain them at the same time.
Yeah.
You hope that they're either deeply moved or amused, but you also want them to go away with a fresh view of the world, make them think, stimulate curiosity. And that, I think, is about a festival as well.
I understood from what Julian was saying that really the measure... as you understand, of art versus entertainment, is the complexity in which it's measured, the levels, the layers of accessibility and measurement that go into it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this often happens, I think, the conversation turns into entertainment, or whether art should be entertaining, which we really need to move away from because we, you know, that really not isn't the proposition, is it? In terms of it is entertaining and should be, but really we're talking about what pays. Where did this distinction come from? You touched on it, and you're suggesting that the simpler the layers, the more potentially reward there is financially, monetary. Is that what I'm understanding?
Kind of, sort of. There are forms that can be complex, but they're still relatively accessible in social terms because they're well known. I mean, you can take... a classic example of this is TV genres. So you can look at a TV genre, but because it is established as a genre, you can work it as a writer and as a producer to good and general effect. It's very hard to do that with an experimental novel. But the forms just aren't there in people's minds. So you have to kind of grow the market, you have to grow the understanding. And as I said, it's a spectrum. It's not like... You know, there's a clear box there which God called art on the third day of creation and then got up the next day and thought, oh, no, we need another word for it. Entertainment for that stuff that's like art that people like. So it doesn't quite work like that. But I mean, I suppose those thoughts come from me looking at how drama scripts work. And drama is an intensely interesting art form because it does span the popular high art divide.
Yeah.
It is one and the same time. It can be the most accessible art form, almost more accessible than any other art form because you don't even need to read. And on the other hand, it can be the most weird thing in a kind of off Broadway loft. So you get to see where these things land and how our culture, which is a commercial culture, construes that. So art and entertainment has always done that span. It's only because we have the economy that we have that we're having this discussion about the money.
Indeed. And I wondered whether or not it is, you know, let's talk about the money. Are there fallacies? Does entertainment pay? I mean, why do people believe that this is, you know, it is really the way? Tell me, does art pay?
Yeah, for some people, of course, it does. You know, there are. Let's look at opera. There's conductors and singers and designers who make a very, very good living. There are visual artists who.
Jeff Koons and his giant poodles.
Well, you know.
And so it's a fallacy, or is it just that it's. It's understood that entertainment...
Maybe it's a little bit more about not pays but art costs.
Yes, okay.
You know, because I think Julian was right in saying, you know, I was thinking on the way from the airport here about Kylie Minogue, for instance. I think Kylie started with clearly a bit of chutzpah, not a huge amount of natural vocal talent, but an incredible amount of persistence and a kind of... really good business sense in a way that allowed her to choose some terrific songwriters, producers, designers, in which she's been able to produce something that has its own integrity within its form, incredibly successful. I think she's a woman of great character. Sure. She, you know, really fantastic. And she wouldn't pretend more than that. And there is a great career path about just being persistent, working very, very hard and making a lot of money. You know, there is a sort of career path. Now, at any time, if anybody had suggested to Kylie that maybe she take part in an experimental theatre show for Two Bob or Takings on the Door, her business sense would probably have said no, or her business manager might have said that's probably not the best idea. I mean, as she became a gay icon, she did start making little appearances in gay clubs in Sydney, for which the community were very, very thankful. But there's a very acute business sense. I think one of the reasons why artists... sometimes appear to end up with no money, or art forms have no money, is that there isn't that clear career path because they're actually pushing the envelope. And if you're pushing the envelope, you don't know. Now, alternatively, it might just be a raggy theatre show or a really funny recording that nobody ever even puts on YouTube because they don't care about it, or as you say, an experimental novel that nobody cares about, or a piece of public art that everybody in the neighbourhood really hates and would rather pull down. But there are some of those completely out there practices that are only about this is the way I see the world, this is what I'm going to do, that will suddenly find a connection in the digital world, suddenly explode. You know, a kid pouring their heart out in their bedroom, just using a computer music mix, and suddenly it's out there in the world. So I don't know that you can. I don't know that we can actually make the case. What we do know, we can't really talk about. Just as we can't tell in 100 years what was actually successful, which is the very best reason for funding all kinds of experiment. Because you just have an infrastructure whereby everybody feels as if they can have a go at doing their stuff, because we don't know in 100 years what was good or bad. I think that's the territory where we also can't quite tell whether it's going to make money or not, because particularly at the moment in the digital age, I think there are so many ways in which things can be picked up, transformed into other forms. And had Andrew been here, I think there would have been a very interesting dimension to that form about how many people saw, what was the original play of Lantana?
Speaking in Tongues.
I saw it here in Adelaide. But how many people saw Speaking in Tongues and how much money that made
compared to the rights to Lantana and
the success?
I think that's a very good example, because Speaking in Tongues started off as two separate fringe plays, which I can remember seeing in Melbourne in 1994 or 95. So the lowest and the wackiest of the lot. So I think the point that you make, that this world is only getting more complex, is absolutely right. But what is also true is that our way of valuing those things is still stuck in the dark ages. So let's shift it into that, because that's the real problem. The problem is not art versus entertainment. We all know that art can be entertaining. We also know that entertainment can be art. Yeah. And long may it consider to be that. But when you deal with things at a policy level or at administrative level, you find people are resolutely either Protestants or Catholics. They are either driven by quantitative criteria and economic modelling, or they are driven by art is opera and I don't go anywhere else.
There's an enormous truth in that, and it is a time in which we need to take the next step. I mean, I'm privileged, no doubt you both have huge experience to I'm on the board of the Adelaide Festival, and we do have to consider what is the intent. You know, who's looking at this? If the government's looking at it, is it about audience numbers and box office? If we're really looking at it in a critical artistic sense, how can it be the best, and how do we measure that? Very, very tricky. Mm.
And there is a really extreme kind of position that you can take,
yeah.
which is if a company or an artist is doing work that the audience already knows and loves, that this is an entirely commercial transaction.
Yes.
And therefore the user should pay.
Yes.
Why? Well, what is the argument for supporting... I mean, there are lots of arguments for supporting art forms that don't do many different things, and that is training, practice, how do you maintain a mainstream culture unless you keep supporting it. But equally, there needs to be an argument which is about supporting, as I said, the unknown, the ugly and the unloved, because that's the way we simply say, have a go at this stuff, we just don't know where it will lead. And if you don't do that, like any business, like any industry, if you don't keep investing in the unknown and those things which don't already have a paying audience, you will go nowhere.
So
you're going to go
backwards.
We've
rewritten a policy here to make sure all government investment, or much government investment, is in premier work predominantly. Is that what we're saying?
No, it's at the moment the government process is, you know, it's a little bit different at the Australia Council. They manage art purely by aggregate category. So mm-hmm. if you talk to a Treasury official about sustainability of opera or ballet, it's very unlikely that you will enter into a discussion about a particular opera that they have seen. That's not going to come. They will sit there with a sheet of numbers and they will make inferences from those numbers. And that's not always the best guide to how to proceed. So I'll give you a practical example.
Good.
In the 1980s, there was a company called Anthill Theatre. They came to the Adelaide Festival a couple of times, 1984, with the production of a Molière play. And they were a tremendously successful small theatre company that fell over in remarkably ugly ways with both funding bodies at the state and Australia Council level in the early 1990s. And that falling over is a process that I looked at in some detail. And partly it was because they wanted more money than the government was able to give. But the real reason that they fell over is because the government at that stage had no notion of touring. They didn't understand how to sustain an alternative business model. So at that time, there was a sense of which if state government was giving you money, all the work had to be in the state. The notion of sustaining your work by going interstate and internationally was not around.
It's now, feudal, isn't it?
Well, even 10 years later, that looks like lunacy. Mm. And you kind of go, well, we crucified
it's
a theatre company because we were as stupid as the mud God made us from.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the mistakes we're currently making?
Mm.
That's my interest.
Okay.
That was a great connection then, because Jean-Pierre Mignon was the founder of Ant Hill, and in watching one of my favourite Australian television dramas, up came Jean-Pierre's name as directing an episode, and very well, very competently. But again, I suppose that's the other face of many, many artists, as if you don't get the support for the absolute things that you want to do. You have to find other... If you have a family, you've got to feed your family. In the end, you've got to find a way to keep living and keep your family living. And so people may find related exercises. Mm. So suddenly to enter into a place of television entertainment, but quality entertainment, is an option for some people. And I think increasingly, I don't know, Christy, at the Adelaide College of the Arts, you must encounter a lot of young people thinking about their futures and where they want to go. And I feel that there are a number of young artists at the moment who don't resent having another kind of income the way my generation might have. We had to be artists in the garret, pure, and you know, you might wait on tables, but you wouldn't do something else. But now, particularly in the areas of things like visual art, somebody might be perfectly happy to get a job in a commercial graphic design company, do their art on the side, crowdfund to support their art, etc. There does seem to be a bit of a sea change in all that, isn't there?
My last production manager is a YouTube star.
There you go.
It's true. No, you're right, Robin. You've touched on certainly what I've perceived over the last few years is that there are a lot of young people now coming into the arts with actually a market in mind in order to make a living, you know, whether it's a craft and that they're actually producing something that they know has got manufacturing, mini manufacturing artisan possibilities to be the best of. That's their intent.
And,
so
do you think that that compromises their idealism about being artists, or is it just being very practical?
Well, this is back to that question. I think it's very practical. I think they are still driven. So if the intent is to make something, make art, the fact that they have an audience in mind, I don't think necessarily detracts from the fact that it's still art. An audience for whether it's, you know, craft manufacturer. I mean, this is obviously another semantic problem with the word art, is that it is so encompassing, isn't it? Mm. You know, we've obviously taken it to mean sort of festivals and theatre predominantly and performing arts in this discussion. But, yeah, we've now thrown over the net over visual arts as well and film and television. Yeah, it's broad.
And Julian, would you think that that would be returning to something more like a Renaissance moment in which, you know, the great sculptors of Florence were entirely dependent on doing gigs for the rich? You know, if you didn't get a commission and you didn't do what they want, you couldn't live.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting comparison to look at that. I haven't done a detailed study of Renaissance patronage. I think it was more competitive than we think it is.
Yeah.
I mean, from a patron's point of view, that there were more options for artists than we give credit for. What I don't think, and I've said this a few times, is I don't think the bureaucratic model of provision works. I don't think you can leave the patronal relationship out with it. I don't want to have another discussion with an arts bureaucrat who knows nothing about art. My first impulse is to kind of go, even if you're grinding the figures, I trained as an economist, so I have no problems with figures whatsoever. If you are charged with, say, the economics of the performing arts in Australia, learn something about the performing arts. And at the moment, the economic modelling that goes into some of those micro areas of our sector are an excuse for not knowing. And I'll give you an example of some of the problems that leads to. You get entrenched views. So when I was at the MTC as a sort of a goodbye present for the company, I looked at the last 11 years of attendances from 1996 to 2007 to see which place had attracted most audiences. And I broke them down by traits and so forth, comedies, you know, ideas, plays. And it was quite interesting, some of the results. But when you do that kind of repertoire analysis, the three foundational categories are classic drama, overseas drama, and Australian drama. That's the three categories. And because I've done this sort of thing before as a historian, I know the order in which they come. It's overseas drama first, classic second, and Australian third. So I did the grinding of the figures for 1996 to 2007, or 2006, and there was a change. It was overseas drama first, Australian drama second, classics third. So I got a call from The Age, and they were like, oh, you know, what are you doing? And I said, oh, well, I've done this thing. And they said, oh, what did it show? And I said, Australian drama second. And they were like, no. And I was like, yes. And they were, no, that can't be. And I was like, yes, really, really it is. And I went to the board and said, you know, this is a major sea change. Yeah. This is a huge change in 50 years of behaviour. And I had no uptake on that shift at all. None at all. And that's amazing. So even with the figures running in my favour, I couldn't change the perception.
And it's a little bit like the art sport argument as well. The figures have been around for a long time at the moment. The stats are that more Australians attend arts and culture events than they do sporting events, and yet still on our news bulletins,
10 minutes of sport.
Including the ABC, you'll get 10 minutes of sport, yeah. You'll even get 3 minutes of weather, but you certainly don't get even 3 minutes of arts. And mostly, the art stories tend to be another angle than art. It's the different angle.
It's the soft story.
It's very interesting
when
in a culture It's in a culture where we rely so heavily on expert opinion and statistics to back everything up. We've got the expertise in the arts. We punch well above our weight in Australia in the arts. We've got the expertise and we've got the stats, and yet the public, the face of the arts to the public still doesn't reflect the realities.
Yeah. I want to ask you both, we've got somebody who'd like to ask a question, and I'll open it up in just a second, but do you think we're in an ism at the moment, and what is it?
That's a good one.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Are we in expressionism or...?
Yes. Is there... it's a broad question, I guess, but I just wonder whether, through all your analysis, particularly, Julian, you know what ism we're in?
Yeah.
Paroxysm. Presentism.
Yeah. I think we're marking time.
Yeah,
That's what I think. To be honest, I mean, that's a very broad statement to make, because fields go up and down and, you know, you see some amazing things wherever you turn. But everything has... we're a very self-praising era. That's what I feel. There's lots of talk, and we create awards and we award each other all these awards.
Yes.
And that's all extremely pleasing, of course. But I suspect in the long term, neither here nor there.
Christy, I would say that if it's not an ism, I reckon one of the fundamental challenges at the moment is the place of the expert. We debated this in Canberra last week, and in an age where everyone has always had an opinion, but now everybody's opinion can be instantly published online. You can all have blogs, you can all have opinions. And so in the arts, there is something that I've referred to in the past as a sort of new revolution in cultural democracy, and all this means is that you can vote for popular dance and popular singing and the television stuff. You can vote, and indeed there are now theatrical questionings of this voting for everything. But the only measure in that is whether a lot of people like it.
Yeah. Yes.
It's only a numbers game. Yeah. And in that, it makes it even more difficult to express different values. Mm. Suddenly, if a lot of people like it, it must be good. Yeah. And that in the arts is certainly not the point, is it?
Well, it can lead to some, because things that start off as art can end up entertaining. And a sort of a good example of that is the Ham funeral that was kept out of the Adelaide Festival in 1960, hated by everybody. And then, 20 years later, post-Nobel Prize... Mm. Considered to be the greatest Australian play of the 20th century, and you kind of go, "Well, how did that work?"
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Questions. Thank you. I'll ask you. Thank you. To
hello. Is this working? Yes, it is.
Yeah. If you mind saying your name and addressing
me. Julianne is my name. Payments and costs. We've been talking about dollars. Are people on the accounting side looking at ways to assess the payments from art that are not easily measurable in dollars? I'm thinking about the payment that comes from taking theatre to a rural or depressed area, or indeed into a depressed workplace, or visual arts, come to that. I'm thinking about the social cohesion that might come from running a visual arts or sculptural workshop in a particular area or amongst a particular demographic.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I have a go at that one?
Please.
Yeah. And that's very interesting that you would raise that. I've just finished Jane Gleason White's book on the double entry accounting system, which is not an academic book, but kind of an airport page turner, really. And she's an art historian and an economist, and she's looking at bookkeeping, basically, and its growth into accountancy. And she talks about the present moment as being defined really by accountants and what they will include and not include on their asset sheets.
But these things, the social cohesion things, they are actually monetarily valuable if somebody wants to make the effort.
If you can grow the economics for it, you have to grow the model. And so she's talking about that predominantly in environmental economics.
Sure.
But I think that the value debate in culture is an adjunct to that. So it is. It's about shifting the numbers and expanding the categories.
Okay. Is anybody doing it?
Yes, you can say it. They are, but slowly. That's my impression. And it's also happening at... It almost has to happen at an international level first, because so many of these things are governed by standards and procedures.
I understand you.
I mean, there's no question that people are taking other values into account. I mean, the whole moment. In fact, it borders on the dangerous in which utilitarian value of the arts is valued, you know, to the extent that you've got to have an education program and a whole lot of other, you know, there are some, I mean, absolutely essential things that most artists and companies would pay mind to anyway. Accessibility in terms of regional outreach, disability, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, etc. There are a whole lot of things, but it also comes into well-being, for instance. Health is better when you use the arts.
I think
all of that is really acknowledged. I understand that the Australian Bureau of Statistics has just put out a whole lot of stuff about how we value arts and culture, because they said some years ago that in fact the ABS had some of the best evaluating processes in the world, but they still found it the most difficult thing to value.
Yeah.
So they've just recently put something out on that. So as Julian said, I think people are moving to. There's no question that there is a valuing of the other things that go into the arts, but it's that slow process of how do we quantify that in a way that will make it meaningful for those who count.
I think one of the issues that you touched on is internationally shared. The methodology needs to be, you know, ruthlessly applied across everything, so that
something like the company Julie's Bicycle, for instance, the founder member of Julie's Bicycle came out to Australia a couple of times, and they have simply been an arts production company who just look to sustainability, and that's why it's called that. And they are getting real results, and because of the results they're getting by being environmentally conscious about the events that they have and the advice they give, they're being asked to do more and more advice on that basis because they can actually measure the outcomes. So if you got a search engine and just go to Julie's Bicycle, she even has a kind of how-to on how to do arts events in a sustainable way. Yeah. So it's starting.
Yeah. There's also, through Flinders University, some significant study now on cultural significance, isn't there? Through tourism as well.
Trying to shift that mindset. Have a look at Jane Gleeson-White's book, and particularly the last chapter, because that goes through the present state.
Right. Thank you.
Hi. My name's Bryony Pierce. I'm entering the arts industry. And I'm curious, thank you. I'm curious, Julian, who are the academics and critics that you admire and why? The fact that they have good methodology that you think is sound.
Yeah, I think you can always take something from everything that you read. There are two people at the moment who I like very much. One is a man called Ben Eltham, who writes a lot for Crikey. And another is a man called Justin O'Connor, who's now at Monash University but was with Stuart Cunningham at Queensland University of Technology. And Justin in particular was part of an advisory group that constructed what I could consider to be an extremely flexible and applicable cultural policy model for the city of Manchester.
I'm going to stop you there. Sorry, Julian, but thank you, Bethany. We're going to try and get through a couple more questions, and we've come to the end of an hour. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Hello, my name is Nathan Rogers. Earlier this year, I agreed to start a music and cultural event where I live, but I found it very difficult to find musical performers who play certain instruments in South Australia. It was physically impossible. So I'm just wondering if we have a cultural shortfall in South Australia. And I also tried to make the event very cheap, where people would only have to pay a gold coin to get in the door. And when I was contacting a lot of musicians, they found that that I was trying to rip them off. Whereas what I was trying to do, as I play piano myself, break down the barriers in terms of music and get people more interested. Because a lot of people out there, they've never been to a classical music concert at all.
I think the question there is: is there enough cultural capital? Are we investing in enough people in Adelaide?
I can give you a contact for a guy called David Sequeira, who is a visual artist, but he produced in Canberra. Canberra is a series, apart from the big iconic buildings, a lot of little villages, and they're like little suburbs, but they've all got their own little shopping centres. And for a couple of years, he did something called the Hughes Festival. And he got each of the shop owners, the pizza bar, the pharmacy, etc., all to make a little contribution. The ticket money went through the tills of the businesses, so he didn't have to do any of the administration. And he put on classical music concerts, and all the shops lent, you know, the pizza bar had chairs, the pharmacist didn't, they lent each other bits and pieces. And he just got a group of musicians and worked out a budget in which he could pay them a little bit that satisfied them. Now, Canberra's a city of 370,000 people. He made it work, and he made it work very successfully, very intimate performances. I'm sure that you would find them, but you probably just need a bit of methodology behind your attempt. So if you like, I'll find a way to get you David Sequeira's number, and he could show you how to do it.
We have two more questions. I'm going to ask you, the organisers, if that's okay. Yes, no? Yes, okay, thanks.
Hi, my name's Tulsa. I was just wondering if, looking at it from the other perspective, that if you think the problem with artists, especially the unknown and the ugly, as you would put it, comes from the fact that there's a generation that aren't being educated on the importance of art, therefore their will to part with money to experience it, not just in a generation that just has real lowbrow entertainment thrust upon them at every angle through internet media, is the importance of real art, like your older visual art, your really mentally stimulating stuff that really makes a difference to the world, isn't being shown importance from a primary school level all the way through to public, like you said, with the news, that barely gets through any time at all. Do you think that is a major problem for artists being able to get income?
Yes.
Agreed. Yes. I think, going to, take the quickly answer, in Adelaide, we've been so lucky to have festivals and to grow up through Come Out and all of that experience, but it's not in education.
It does raise a fascinating other side that you've raised, that is how there are so many opinions that art is so expensive and yet people will pay $150 to go and see their favourite rock band. So actually, I always think there's a price barrier to the arts, but when I look at the prices of popular concerts, I think people are willing to spend. It's just, again, it's about how to value it.
Yeah. Challenging.
Isn't it? It's about do you value it?
And you can put it in a pithy way. You know, I could say something like, entertainment is about options and art is about decisions. And, you know, that opposition doesn't quite work, but it alerts you to the different challenges that are involved in both of those equations.
But education's key.
That's pretty much a wrap-up, isn't it? But we have one more question. Thank you.
Mihaila, and I was interested when you... the question is going to be more on the entertainment side, because I'm a media student and I consume a lot of TV and visual stuff. Throughout the last, say, 5 years, there's been a lot of explosion on people watching stuff from America stuff, well, HBO stuff and premium cable stuff, and often there's been then a perception that the stuff that Australia creates isn't as good. My question is towards the budgeting side and how the government basically funds it, and there are certain requirements which have to be made for you to get funding. Often has to be, I think, an Australian story and historical stuff, and I think that's kind of boring. And I think, why can't we have something more of a something interesting, something more thought-provoking than some of the same old stuff?
Okay.
Or do we already have that and I'm not, I don't know about it, or what?
Well, I guess the wrap-up question there might go to the Deputy Chair of the Australia Council.
Yes.
Are the funding methods
are they like too restrictive, basically, because they have to be a certain way, or... For example, why can't we create something like House of Cards or, I don't know, some other
stuff? Actually, we might take that on notice, because that's a very good question. It's a broad question. We really don't have time to answer it tonight.
Okay.
So right now, because we have run out of time, but thank you for taking the opportunity
to
speak.
We can at least change the question, though. You say why can't, and I would say why don't. Why don't we make it? Because the budget of The Killing is comparable with any TV series we make here. So that's... We can discuss that with a cup of tea, eh?
Yeah, and I would just say, although I don't think the Australia Council's focus will ever change from Australian work, they have actually loosened up so that it is not impossible these days to do a Shakespeare and be automatically disqualified from funding. I think that's loosened up. And the recent change, the new Australia Council Act, has actually changed things so that it can be... It hadn't changed for 40 years, and I know that at the moment there is a revision of the grant program. And I think you probably find, it's going to take a little while, but probably a year or 2 years, I think you will find the Australia Council will take the lead in being a bit more flexible, a little bit more able. It's not that there's not been the willingness before, but a little bit more able to fund more and more experiment, new forms, multimedia, etc. like that. I think you'll start to notice a few changes in the future. Now, that's not speaking for state art departments, but quite often what the Australia Council does when it does something good is taken as a bit of a sign, and we might find that there is a bit of opening up in the future, a bit of simplification in applying for grants, etc., and that would be a great thing.
Well, thank you very much for your attendance. I think to sum up that this has been a very entertaining discussion for me, certainly, about a very, very important topic, and the arts absolutely matter. Have a wonderful afternoon for the last day of the Festival Ideas, and let's thank the organisers and these two wonderful people. Thank you.
This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.